Blog Talk Radio.
Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world better place if you can.
This is Leslie Gist, and you're listening to the Gist of Freedom live show. We have on the line tonight Miss Martha Swan. Martha, are you on a telephone?
I am, Leslie. How are you this evening?
I'm doing very good. Could you tell the audience who you are and why you're on our show tonight?
My name is Martha Swan. I live in the Adirondack region of Upper New York State, where John Brown and many of the raiders who joined him at Harper's Ferry in 1859 are buried. And I am the director of a freedom education project called John Brown Lives.
Wonderful. Now, exactly what is the mission of your organization?
Well, the mission of John Brown Lives is to promote racial justice and human rights through involving communities, schools, artists, teachers in digging up and looking at and recovering and celebrating the freedom history of our region.
How did you get involved in particular?
Say that again, please.
How did you get involved?
How did I get involved? Well, so many roads pointed to it. I moved to the Adirondacks in 1997 and was amazed to discover that there was this freedom history here. There was the story of the antebellum voting rights and land grant program for black New Yorkers in the 1840s and early 1850s, which first and foremost is what drew John Brown to the area. And that whole episode, that whole chapter of New York State freedom history was pretty, if it wasn't overlooked, when it wasn't completely overlooked, I should say, it was distorted. This whole notion of, the whole plan of New York abolitionists, black and white, in the 1840s, to not only try to do what they could to end slavery, but also to empower black New Yorkers who were grossly disenfranchised at the voting booth because of land requirements, property owning requirements. There was this, you know, very grandiose. One of the black abolitionists who was involved in this project, he described it as a scheme of justice and benevolence. which ended up in, I think it was 3,000 black New Yorkers, men, receiving title to land, which would put them on the road to meeting the property requirement to vote. And so, I mean, that in and of itself is this rich New York statewide touchstone to a very, very important chapter, not only in anti-slavery, but in freedom and equality history.
Well, I have two questions that
sure.
came to mind while you were speaking. The first being the voting rights. You said 1840. Now, I was under the impression that we weren't able to vote, we meaning black people, until the 60s. Could you explain to the audience
I'll do my best, but I have to say, I have to remind you, Leslie, that I'm not a historian. But I'll do my best. In the 1820s, men in New York had the right to vote. Women did not, but men did, black and white, if they could meet a property requirement. Now, of course, in the 1820s in New York State, how many black men could meet a property requirement? Very, very few, if any, but very, very few. And then in 1846, there was a referendum. I think it was a constitutional convention. And put before the voters of New York State was this question as to whether black men should still be required to meet this property requirement. And prior to that referendum, that constitutional referendum, both black and white men had to show that they owned $100 worth of land, $100 worth of property. In 1846, the voters of New York, through this convention, constitutional convention, I believe it was, they decided that they eliminated the property owning requirement for white men, but they nearly tripled it for black men. So from that point forward, white men did not have to show that they owned property, but black men had to show that they owned $250 worth of property. So I mean, that's a big ouch, right? That's an important chapter in, okay, so you have the right on paper, but try to meet that requirement. You know, try to get over that hurdle. So Gerrit Smith, who was a very, very wealthy, arguably one of the largest, if not the largest, landowner in the state of New York at that time, an abolitionist himself, white abolitionist in the Peterborough, Central New York, Cazenovia region, and black abolitionists had for years been agitating for voting rights and equality, you know, political equality and social civic equality in New York State. And I think it's fair to say that Gerrit Smith and John Brown were among the handful of white abolitionists who also championed equal political rights for blacks in New York State. So this plan was developed to give away, as I said earlier, 120,000. No, let me see, get my numbers right. I think it was 140 acres of land to 3,000 black New Yorkers. So it resulted in, and these were men in nearly every county of the state who received 40 acres of land. Now, whether they ever saw that land, whether they ever moved to that land, because most of it was up here in the Adirondack region, Essex County, Franklin County, you know, these are regions that are kind of remote now, and we have, right, you know, trains and planes and automobiles. So imagine in the 1840s and 1850s, this is remote, wilderness, you know. So it really had this political rights dimension to it. I think, well, it's hard to say. I was going to say first and foremost, but, you know, Gerrit Smith, the guy who owned all this land, he was a big believer in the power and the importance of being close to the land and being able to farm the land and derive sustenance from the land. I think ideals that many people today are returning to.
Right.
Anyway, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question directly. Probably not. But it was that a few dozen families who had received title to land up here in the Adirondacks, they actually decided, you know, as families to pack up from Troy and pack up from Albany and pack up from other places around the state where they were living and try their hand at homesteading in the Adirondacks. And that caught John Brown's attention. And
so are you saying that this area became a historically black town?
No, it's not. As the settlements are not as concentrated as that. Up here, the population density was then and is now very, very low. For example, I mean, I lived in Brooklyn before I moved up here, and there were more people on the train in the morning going into Manhattan for work than live in the town that I live in, you know. So, but what there was enough proximity of the settlement of the families who moved up here, some of the families, that they became identified as sort of communities. They identified themselves as community and were identified as community. And in letters, we have evidence from John Brown's letters and one or two, maybe three written sources that I'm aware of, where this one settlement area, which is not necessarily contiguous land, but close to where John and Mary Brown lived, it came to be called Timbuktu. There was another settlement of a few small handful of families in Franklin County.
Now, what is the significance of being called Timbuktu?
Well, you know, I don't know about you, Leslie, but when I was a child, I grew up hearing this expression, well, he's gone to Timbuktu, or he's off to Timbuktu and back again, or that'll happen. This reference to Timbuktu as this faraway, remote, unattainable, but idealized place. Did you ever grow up with that?
Yes.
Timbuktu and back again?
Right.
And what do you remember about that? How did that start?
Not much. Like, it didn't seem like a sad place. It seemed like something, like you said, like a mysterious place.
Yeah, but did you think it was real?
No.
I didn't either. I thought it was made up. But it was, I mean, I have to say, this is my own ignorance. You know, here I was in my, I don't even want to say how old I was, but, you know, I was well into adulthood when I just, you know, I learned that Timbuktu was most probably, I think it's quite certainly, a reference to the intellectual, scholarly, religious, commerce crossroads of Timbuktu in the country of Mali in Western Africa.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, in the 1830s or 1840s, newspapers were beginning, and particularly in the black press in the United States, in the Northeast, they were beginning to publish these serials of discoveries or information about Timbuktu. So I think it had a, it was a place that had very, very noble and deep, very noble connections, very, and a very long, long, long standing cultural traditions.
So this town, which was famous or was well known for helping African Americans obtain property was renamed Timbuktu.
Well,
or
no.
Given a name.
You know, it wasn't a town. The town is called North Elba, and I don't know when the town was incorporated and when that name, when it acquired that name, or even what that name refers to. And Timbuktu, it was never incorporated. You'll have to come up and see.
Okay.
You'll have to come up and you know.
So it was just a nickname.
Kind of.
Okay.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I think that's kind of a
well,
term.
Well, I appreciate you being able to bring back the history of the multicultural dynamics of John Brown and to explain where he was living. And that says a lot about his character. Now, for those listeners who don't know why John Brown is so famous, could you explain?
Oh, I'll do my best. John Brown was a white abolitionist born in the year 1800 who, from a very, very young age, I think it's around the age of 9, he witnessed some of the horrors of slavery around him as a young boy and dedicated his life increasingly as years went on and as slavery became more and more entrenched. He dedicated his life and raised his family to dedicate their lives to ending slavery in the United States. But not only that, in addition to that, he also was someone who, as his letters suggest, as the way he lived suggest, and the way he died or how he died suggests that he was a white person who believed to the core of his being that blacks and whites were equal in the eyes of God and were brothers and sisters, and that the cause of freedom and dignity and you know, the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was just as much a right for blacks in the United States as it was for him and his family. So as the country was becoming more, as slavery was becoming more, even more entrenched, more institutionalized and legalized, he came to the conclusion that the mournful conclusion, I think it's fair to say, that blood would have to be shed. And he was involved in the Underground Railroad. He was an abolitionist in the sense of, you know, he spoke out against slavery. But he reached the point where he believed that, you know, talk and organizing and political agitation, that it really was not going to be enough to end slavery. So he developed this plan. He studied the French Revolution. He was a great admirer of the Haitian Revolution. He studied, I think it's fair to say, you know, guerrilla warfare and the geography of the eastern part of the United States, and developed this plan to what he's famous for is for raiding a federal arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia. It was Virginia at the time. And his plan was to, you know, raid this arsenal, gather up all these arms, and I think inspire people, black people in particular, in the South, to follow him and his fellow raiders into the mountains and lead then a series of raids and you know, even more, perhaps more to the point, a sort of psychological destabilizing of the whole institution of slavery.
What did the Bleeding Kansas have to do with his raid? Could you explain, if you know?
Well, I'll do my best. I don't know what the year was.
5 years before. I would think around 5 years before the Harper's Ferry raid.
That's probably right. Where Kansas was not yet a state, it was a territory, and the decision as to whether Kansas would become a state, be entered into the United States as a free state or a slave state was the question of the day. And John Brown, in response to a request from his sons to come out to Kansas to help defend the territory and ensure that it be entered into the Union as a free state and not as a slave state, he went out there and he joined them. And from accounts that I've read and have heard from different scholars is that Kansas, I mean, it was called Bloody Kansas. You know, it was called Bloody Kansas because it was kind
first
of
Civil War.
Pardon me?
It was probably the first Civil War.
Oh, that's interesting, Leslie. I've never heard anybody describe it as that. You know, it may have been the first battleground. That's a really interesting, compelling thing to think about. But yeah, it was, you know, people really trying to determine what way this state was going to go and how the country would follow. So, you know, and I think the experience is there because the border, what they were called the border ruffians, people coming over the border from Missouri in particular, trying to ensure that when this vote was taken, when this decision was made, that Kansas would go the way of other slave states, it was pretty hellish.
Who won? Which side won?
Well, Kansas was admitted to the country as a free state, but it wasn't over. It still wasn't decided on a national level at that point. So, you know, we have the Fugitive Slave Law, which made it legal for anyone who was, you know, to round up, to make even a citizen's arrest of someone who was believed to be a slave or an escaped slave.
Where?
That was a federal law.
And they could go into the North.
Sure.
And accuse a free black person of being a runaway slave, right?
Right, exactly. So there were many indicators on the horizon that slavery was not that it was indeed expanding and not going to be debated away and not going to be preached away, not going to be editorialized away, but that, you know, I mean, John Brown believed he departed company from many others in his belief that black people had the right and the need to defend themselves. So, you know, to be armed and to be active agents in their own liberation was something that he I think very firmly believed. And that is borne out in the composition of the men who joined him in Harper's Ferry, because the raiders were black and white. So, you know, arming black men in 1859 to participate in their own liberation and the liberation of their people was something that was very, it hadn't happened. It hadn't happened. And even when the Union Army, you know, when the Civil War began and the Union Army was formed, it took quite some time and some considerable persuasion in the North before black soldiers, black regiments were allowed, really.
Now, the Harper's Ferry raid took place in 1859, and the Civil War began when?
1860 or 1861. It was very shortly thereafter.
Right. Do you remember hearing a story about Sumner?
Not really.
Sumner?
In the debates in Congress?
Right. He was the senator that was bashed over the head.
Right. Right.
Right,
I don't remember
leaving Kansas, right there before Congress.
Right. Right. If that isn't an indication of just how vociferous and entrenched the supporters of the institution of slavery were, that you know, there on the floor of Congress, that he was a senator, right?
Right.
That he could be beaten quite severely for his opposition to slavery.
Wow. Well, you said a lot about John Brown, and you really covered a lot in history.
Well, I'm not a historian, so I have to apologize for any gapes and holes. But
right. Now, talk about what you're going to be doing on Saturday, June 12th.
Well, the community in Peterborough, which is where Garrett Smith lived, and I just want to refer back to him as someone, as the abolitionist who was very active, and who was the person who gave away all this land, which led to thousands of black men across New York State receiving title to land. The people in Peterborough have been helping, really, really doing a great deal to revisit the history of the area and the abolitionist history of that part of New York State and its connection to the larger struggle to end slavery and the Civil War. So this is, I think it might be the 18th year. It's quite a few years that they have a weekend-long program, which includes Civil War reenactment and talks and displays and that kind of thing. So I've been asked to come and talk about John Brown and the project that I direct, John Brown Lives. So I'll be talking, you know, a bit about John Brown, the events and the time in which he lived that I think gave shape to his reaching the point where he won not only that he was committed to ending slavery and racial equality, not ending racial equality, but believing in racial equality and living by a high value on that, but also I'll also be talking about the work of John Brown Lives and the efforts most recently to try to keep the farm from closure in the face of the state budget crisis and
the state-run farm.
Yeah, it's been a New York State Historic Site since the 1890s.
Wow.
It's been continuously operated for more than 100 years as a site for the people, really, and it's one of the few, very, very few, if not the only, site that is squarely a site dedicated to a person who was involved in the anti-slavery struggle.
Wow, that's very impressive. Now, tell us a little bit about the National Abolitionist Museum.
Oh, well, again, the very visionary and dedicated, hardworking people in Peterborough, Dot Wilsey and Norm Dan and Beth Sulkowski and others, they've been working for years to try to, again, you know, train our attention to some of our forebears who held egalitarian ideals, whose idea of justice was one that it was indivisible. And so they launched, I remember, you know, maybe 8 years ago, Leslie, we had a program at the John Brown Farm. And I remember as it was ending, meeting this couple who said that they thought that we, you know, the larger we, needed a National Abolitionist Hall of Fame. And, of course, you know, we have the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Boxing Hall of Fame and this Hall of Fame and that Hall of Fame. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. You know,
what?
Putting putting people engaged and committed to the struggle for justice, to elevating them, which, you know, largely they're in the shadows in our country and as history is taught and told, and elevating them, putting them on par, sort of ironically, perhaps, with these other icons of American culture and society, you know, our athletes and our musicians and so forth, which is not to disparage our athletes and musicians, not for a minute, but, you know, I thought that was such a very creative concept. So you know, Dot and Norm and others, they have set about to create, to one, draw attention to Garrett Smith and who he was and all of his commitment and complexity and the issues that he really worked to try to influence in his time, but also to lift up for the public to think about and learn about and learn from these abolitionists, some well-known and some much, much lesser known, who in their time, in their day, grappled with and committed themselves to confronting one of the most important social issues. So,
what characteristics do you think you share with the men and women of yesteryear that were abolitionists? Because, you know, this is a time where you see the Tea Partiers getting a lot of attention in the press. But what is it in you and in the people like John Brown that really wanted to make you fight for justice for people outside of your race that looks nothing like you and really could only cause you harm and no benefits as far as physically speaking?
Oh, Leslie, that's such a hard thing to answer. Because I don't feel like I can, you know, I don't feel like I can put myself in the same, you know, sort of echelon of our forebears.
Well, we'll let the future, you know, prove your statements to be true or false. So your grandchildren.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Okay, and
but
I won't
really,
have to answer.
Well, why would you want to fight for, you know, this justice in the face of so many obstacles?
Well, because it's just plain. You know, it's plain to see for me. You know, there's this extraordinary privilege that the society affords people with white skin. And I've been aware of that. You know, I couldn't figure it out. You know, I couldn't name it as a young person. But, you know, in recent years, largely because of all of the scholarship and the deep, deep, you know, probing and examination and discussion that people have been doing around issues of race and racism in our country, I've been able to kind of identify and you know, name and explain to myself things that I thought were sort of going on, undercurrents and undertones, or even more overt things, you know, growing up. So I think I do have, you know, a deep sense of equality and human dignity and a sense of rights that we all have and should have access to enjoy. And, you know, I'll tell you the truth, Leslie, that doing this work, it's joyful work, you know? I don't suffer anything from it, really, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's some of the most joyful work I've ever been able to do, and to be engaged with people who are similarly, you know, committed is really a privilege. So, I don't know. I don't really have any battle scars. Again, I think it's another, you know, expression of the privilege I enjoy as a white person.
Well, we won't ever hear, or I never heard anyone ask anyone like yourself that type of question, and I know a lot of people would want to, you know, hear your answer. I just think it's commendable what you're doing, that you're on the forefront to, you know, raise awareness. And I just want to commend you and thank you for
well, and thank
you
too for the work that you're doing. You know, with the programs, with the website, with the dialogue that you encourage and make possible.
Well, let's talk. We only have a few more minutes in the interview. So
okay.
Do you want to talk about the farmhouse, or do you want to, you know, what part of John Brown really excites you the most, or you know, what happened? Give me an epiphany of something that you experienced in your life that made you say, I have to do something. Let me just stop what I'm doing, and I have to get involved.
I guess it was, okay, this is where I want to take that question.
Okay.
Looking forward, not so much backwards. And this is an invitation to people listening to this conversation. Back in December, when we were observing the 150th anniversary of John Brown's the raid on Harper's Ferry and the trial and his execution and his body being brought back home to the Adirondacks up here, we had a conference, and one of the participants said, you know, we really need to remember the Black Raiders who also fought and died with John Brown. So I said, oh, my God, of course. And we put out a kind of call on December 16th. That was the date that two of the Raiders, two of the Black men who joined John Brown, John Copeland and Shields Green, they were captured and tried and sentenced to death. And they were executed on December 16th, 1859, about 2 weeks after John Brown. So on that day, December 16th, 2009, we put out a call for 100 anti-slavery conventions around New York State, drawing inspiration and instruction from our abolitionist forebears to reactivate, recommit ourselves, and activate ourselves not only to studying and examining the freedom history, slavery, and the freedom history of the past, but also to work today to end slavery that exists in the world today, including in our own country, including here in New York State. The human trafficking, the global slavery, the in all of the forms that it takes. So I think that's the most, probably the most important thing to carry forward from this conversation,
right,
that there's great inspiration and example and instruction that we can take from our abolitionist forebears in the struggle for the ongoing struggle to understand and try to, I don't know, heal, restore, you know, the verb is failing me right now, but the terrible wounds and legacy of slavery in our country in this, from the 1600s to the Civil War, but the legacy of slavery in our country, and then slavery as it exists in the world today.
Perfect. Now, is there a number or website or PayPal account that one could get involved with if we wanted to donate to your cause?
Well, they could. I have to say the website is under construction, but if anybody wanted to call me, they certainly could. And that number is 518-962-4758. Or I suppose I could give my email address, right?
Yes.
That's mswan, S-W-A-N, at capital, C-A-P-I-T-A-L, dot net.
Okay, I misspelled your last name on the website, on the post.
Did you give me two N's?
Yes.
That's okay. So when I'm saying, you know, when I'm telling someone my name for the first time, I usually say Swan, just like the bird. So they get it, but that's okay.
Now, how long has the museum, the National Abolitionist Museum, been up and running?
I would say, oh gosh, at least, I think at least 6 years.
Wow, that's very impressive. And
where are you
the
located?
Farmhouse.
Oh, the farmhouse.
Do you need people to come out to help support the your cause to keep it open?
What they could do is contact the governor's office of New York State, Governor David Paterson. The last I knew, and this was as of yesterday, earlier in the week, the governor had announced this plan to keep the parks and historic sites open, but to do so by taking $6 million from the vitally important Environmental Protection Fund. You know, and that's a non-starter. That's not a solution, you know, to take from the fund that New Yorkers have been contributing to since the early 90s for air and water, clean water protection, for land and open space protection. I mean, really a very important part of the public good and the good of the natural world. So there's been, I think, a pretty vociferous campaign mounted against that, and I believe that the legislature also is trying to convey to the governor's office that you know, that's just not that's not a solution by any means. So anyone who wanted to contact Governor David Paterson's office to urge him to not only keep all of the New York State parks and historic sites open, because this is the public good and this is our public, these are our taxes, you know, these are our
it's our facilities.
Yeah, exactly.
And our history.
And our history. There has to be another way, you know, to fund these places, to keep them open.
Your last question. If you could recommend a book for a teacher, high school, grammar school, which book would you recommend? Or
oh.
Video.
Oh, wow. That's such a difficult question. Well, I just started looking at last night a book called, let me see if I can find it. It's called Complicity, How the North Prolonged, Promoted, and Profited from Slavery. I might have some of those P's wrong, but it's called Complicity. And I think that particularly now, as we're on the verge of commemorating the Civil War with all kinds of programs and reenactments and military living history and focus on the military, I think it's really, really important that we as a people, and as a people in the North, those of us who are listening or tuning in the North, that we educate ourselves about slavery in the North, you know, in New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts and so forth, because I think that for a very, very long time, you know, since the Civil War, probably we have, people in the North have looked upon the South as, have looked upon slavery as that peculiar Southern institution, and we have really glossed over the fact that the North, you know, I think that most of us by now know that you know, Wall Street and Boston and Rhode Island, that, you know, these major commercial and financial centers, that they profited from slavery, but there was slavery on the ground, you know. And there's this quite remarkable book that I've just started to look at last night. So that's right, that's in the top of my, it's fresh in my mind. And so I'll recommend that, because I do think it's really important that we educate ourselves about slavery in the North.
I want to thank you again, Martha Swan with One Inch, for joining us tonight.
Okay.
This is great. And we will keep in touch.
Okay, and Leslie. Thank you so much.
Anytime, and we'll have you back on whenever you can come back.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, have a good
bye-bye
night.
Bye-bye now. You too. Bye-bye.
Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world better place if you can. Reach out and touch somebody's hand. Make this world better place if you can. Would I be